I'm Christopher Lydon with the sage of New Haven, the sublime critic Harold Bloom, who has read and remembered all the great books and set them to talking with each other in his fertile mind. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Harold, I've been living inside this book of yours, The Anatomy of Influence, Literature as a Way of Life. It keeps reminding me of an Emerson line that is not in the book, but he said, as you know, there is no history.
Only biography.
Only biography. And I keep thinking, so many suggestions
here. That infuriated my late friends, two great men, C. Van Woodward and Robert Penn Warren.
Why?
They were both outraged by it. They both believed in history. Van, who was, after all, a professional historian, and read, like all fellows from the Badlands of Kentucky, Tennessee, hated Ralph Waldo.
Yeah. And you believe in literature, but there are so many little biographical hints coming through this book. You in the Bronx Public Library, your father, as I take it, a garment worker, but growing up in the 30s in a Yiddish household.
You must remember, young man, allow me to interrupt you, O noble Leiden, this book was cut down from a manuscript, maybe you can see it over there at the bottom of that pile on that chair. It was cut down from something almost twice that size. What vanished from it was a great deal of unconsciously autobiographical reflection and meditation. And indeed, I'm currently at work upon three projects. The first, which you find me in the midst of, is writing a book called Evening of the Imagined Land, and the subtitle is Achievement in American Literature, and it covers 16 figures from the sacred Ralph Waldo to end in the great Faulkner. We will not go past that in this book, and perhaps ever. And then this is the first time I've said this in public or private. Even my wife doesn't know this. I'm writing for stage presentation a work possibly called Walt Whitman, A Musical Pageant.
Oh, right.
And it's an attempt to break away from commentary into another different, very different kind of a mode. And we'll talk about that, not this time, since I might spoil it by talking about it.
But can I ask you one?
And then I'm going to write something called The Hum of Thoughts Evaded in the Mind. My working title is Hum, H-U-M. It is a great line from Wallace Stevens's Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction, The Hum of Thoughts Evaded in the Mind, and the subtitle I haven't decided on yet, a kind of, I might call it a partial self-portrait. It will be a kind of literary memoir or autobiography, but it will not discuss my marriage, my children. It will just talk about, so it's sort of an embryonic form there, but we mostly cut it out of that. Thank you so much, Gene. So,
thank you, Gene.
Kinderlock, let us go on. You have to eat.
To me, it's a great untold story so far, Harold, how this child of the Bronx Public Library became Samuel Johnson. How
you my dear. I love you madly, badly, sadly, and gladly. Well, excuse me. The great Schmoll, the grand sham of literature. No, he's beyond me.
Okay. There are matters of degree.
I regard myself as a worshiper at his sacred shrine, even if he was, like the abominable Eliot, whom I don't worship, Anglican in religion, royalist in politics, and classicist and deeply conservative in all cultural matters, except that I've become that also, and I'm now attacked for it. But go on.
I have a burning question about this book itself. I miss the old title, The Living Labyrinth, partly because it's so perfect word for the way your mind works. All that stuff inside talking to itself.
Pardon me, oh noble Chris, is it not the way that your mind works also?
Well, with much less in
it. All of us literary cultural types are labyrinthine in our complexities, aren't we?
Well, yes.
And I dare say that your marvelous body of auditors who will listen to this in some form or another after you have edited it down, I dare say they are labyrinthine in their complexities also. They're sinuosities, you might want to say.
Absolutely. But most of us are thinking of the names of rock and roll drummers or baseball players or boxers from the 1930s or something.
I also, as a wretched Yankee fan, because I think they're awful this year, I can take you back throughout Yankee history. Every minor league creature who showed up as a reserve infielder, I can tell you all about. But this is not a good year for that. The Red Sox are going to beat us by about 15 games.
Let's hope. They're finally in a groove. But
I don't hope it. I loathe it. The fascist Red Sox, I always call them.
Why?
Because my dad, if you want biography or autobiography or memoir, at the age of six in 1936, my splendid Uncle Sam Kaplan took me to my first big league game in Yankee Stadium. It was on my birthday, July the 11th, 1936. I was 6 years old. There was a rookie in left field. He switched to center field the next year, named Joseph Paul DiMaggio. And like all potential Yankee fans, I said, oh, my God, look at him. By the way, he has inspired my life to a considerable degree, even though he wasn't obviously a very charming human being from everything one knows about him and his relation to poor old Marilyn and so on. But have you and I ever talked about this? We might have.
No, but talk
occasionally,
about
occasionally, for instance, recently, I don't go out and give lectures anymore because, you know, a year and a half ago, I very nearly died of my latest health crisis and so on. But I, because of this new book, The Anatomy of Blumo or whatever it's called, I consented to appear after a hiatus of 4 or 5 years, two occasions in New York, one at the 42nd Street Library and the other at some little theater on 13th Street. I was very exhausted for both of them. I really shouldn't be lecturing in public at this point in my life. Because at Yale, I just teach now two seminars of 12 children each, very carefully selected. That's what I'm good for. Particularly since in bad weather, they wind up in the living room here. And they seem very kind about indulging me in that regard. Any case, for many years now, and this must have started 30, 40 years ago, after all, I'm almost 81 now, I will be very shortly, for about my 40th year on, again and again, when for one reason or another, I've been on the road or elsewhere and too exhausted to lecture, but a brand new audience, many of whom had never seen me before in front of me. I remember a great anecdote. I think it was the sports writer Milton Gross, and he said in the very twilight of Joe's career, must have been in the 50s, and he had Mickey Mantle on one side of him.
I was going to say, you talk about the anxiety of influence. How about Mickey Mantle playing in Joe DiMaggio's center field?
Yes, indeed.
Not to mention Duke Snider and Willie Mays.
Never
mind. Town.
Yes, yes. The great position in New York in those days. It was Dom DiMaggio with you fascists, I remember.
You imperialists.
Jolting Joe's younger brother.
Who's greater than his brother Joe? Dominic DiMaggio.
We used to hear the chant. Then there was Vince, who played outfield for the Pittsburgh Pirates in the old days. Do you remember him?
Sure.
But in any case, yes, the anecdote. So Stengel was the manager. It must have been indeed in the early 1950s, 51, 52. And the Yanks had already clinched the pennant that we're going to play in the World Series and so on. And he'd been benching Joe, who was a mass of exhaustions and, joints aching and so on. He must have at that point been about 39, 40 years old, whatever it was, 38 to 40. And he put him into a game against the soon-to-be defunct St. Louis Browns out in St. Louis. And there were no more than perhaps 1,500 people in the stands, but they'd come there to see DiMaggio. Mm. And Stengel told him, Joe, you're going to take it easy. I need you for the World Series. And you're going to play only 3 or 4 innings. But as Gross put it, Joe was like a madman. He went 4 for 4 or something like that. He ran out singles so that it became doubles. He ran out a double sliding on his belly into third base successfully. He made sliding catches in center field on his belly. Stengel tried twice to take him out, and Joe said, go away, Casey. Afterwards, caked with mud, too exhausted to take a shower, he was sitting in the Yankees' dressing room, and Milt Gross came up to him and said, Joe, why did you do it? You know, Stengel was gnashing his teeth, tearing what was left of his hair, and almost mud-caked, peering at him with exhausted eyes, DiMaggio uttered a very great sentence. Milt, why can't you see it? Somewhere in that stadium were people who had never seen Joseph DiMaggio play before. Isn't that magnificent?
It's a great, great line.
The hubris of that. So that's, yeah. I'm not Joe DiMaggio, I'm not Shmuel Johnson, but nevertheless, even this last spring on those two occasions in New York, totally exhausted, I said to myself, there are people in both these audiences who have never seen Harold Bloom talk before. So that got me through. But go on.
That's a gorgeous line. It compares with Ted Williams' line, age 19, arriving at the Red Sox and saying, all I want is that when I walk down the street someday, people will say, there goes the greatest hitter that ever lived.
A tremendous, a heroic, a fantastic performer. He actually hit 400 one year.
406.
406, the last person to do that.
Yeah. That's what you call a strong poet, I think.
A very strong poet.
This is my point exactly. And let's be a little vulgar about it, but isn't it time, in terms of the anxiety of influence, isn't it time for a great map, a sort of board game, maybe an interactive digital feature on the influence of poets? In other words, identifying this line in Emily Dickinson as an echo of a Shakespearean sonnet, or here's what Joyce is using out of Dante. We're talking about degrees of separation. We're talking sort of baseball cards for literature.
You sound like Mr. Guare. How many degrees of separation?
The playwrights. Yeah.
Come on.
What about baseball cards for literature?
Who would buy them?
Well,
commerce above all, my boy. This is the United States in 2011. The only reason, especially with the prospect of Sarah, God, I hope. My real dream ticket is that Sarah gets the nomination over the dead body of the Republican establishment and then chooses as a vice presidential candidate the peerless Michelle Bachmann. What a ticket. What a ticket.
Well,
two real broads.
Well, you know, Bill James in baseball has not reduced the game statistically, but he has certainly simplified the big lines of it, what's really going on. Isn't that something like what you have done in literature, Harold?
In a way. What are they called? Sabermetrics?
Yeah, exactly.
The sabermetrics of literature.
Fantasy baseball of literature.
Fantasy. Well, literary criticism, in a sense, is fantasy literature. What else can it be?
Explain that, yeah.
Well, I'm on record in this book and elsewhere, though I'm always denounced for it, as saying that there is no way to have useful literary criticism, particularly anything that has even the slightest chance of survival in the minds of those who are good enough to read it or who need it or want it, that is not in some sense part of literature itself. And that is behind my saying in this sabermetrics analog or trope that we are working out.
You and sports fans are equally fascinated with this whole Agon thing, contests. Who is the ultimate heavyweight champion?
I say that at the beginning of this book as well as at the end of it. I once wrote an entire book called Agon. What I'm talking about is simply comes out of Longinus, and before that it comes out of Athenian practice. Hmm. People forget it was, in fact, the great Nietzsche, accompanied by Jakob Burckhardt, who revived in the 19th century the truth about Greek agon. Everything in Athens, and indeed in the rest of Greece, since they were so imitative of Athens, everything turned upon contest, not just Pindar celebrating the victories in the great games, but also, in fact, Pindar, speaking about his own work as he does it in those fantastic odes, which I spent a whole semester once studying at Cornell University, where I was a classics undergraduate, as well as an English one. And he is deeply competitive with, his agon is with Bacchylides, who is outshot by him, who's outarmed by him, who can't compete with him, who can compete with Pindar. Hart Crane, who called himself the Pindar for the machine age. A rather ironic remark, I suspect. And the great Hart Crane, still my favorite poet. I mean, Shakespeare is Shakespeare. John Milton is John Milton. Walt Whitman is Walt Whitman. But the poet I've loved best since I was about 9.5 or 10 years old is Hart Crane, and that will never change. I will no doubt die with Hart Crane on my lips. But go on.
Come back. This whole notion of contest, you picture Henry James in a kind of contest with Walt Whitman. You picture James Joyce in a kind of lifelong contest with Shakespeare. Does it help or not? Or is it stupid to compare your game in literature with trying to figure out whether Rocky Marciano would have beaten Muhammad Ali?
Marciano and Muhammad Ali? Muhammad Ali would have danced around him. Marciano was slow moving, but if he had gotten even one massive blow,
right,
he could have killed the great Cassius Clay.
I think Jack Johnson might win it all.
The White Hope period, I remember, yes.
Yeah.
The madness of the United States. Think of right now. The real thing animating, I mean, when I say fascist Red Sox, I'm just being a Yankee fanatic. But the word can be used precisely in terms of American native fascism in regard to the Tea Party. What they really feel about Obama is we must get rid of him. Too bad we can't shoot him because he is a black. But think how sick our country still is. The now, alas, fading, and I wish he had retired because his great days are over. He can hardly hit his weight and hasn't got much lateral movement anymore. Derek Jeter, still the Yankee captain, but that's what's wrong with the Yankees at the moment. Posada's 40 years old and can't hit anymore. He should be out of there. All these high salaried, they're overpaid, they're underachieving. Girardi has an impossible job. As for the great A-Rod, he seems dead also. I don't know what it is with him. No, the Yankees are not going to win this year. They'll finish third in the East behind Tampa, which is a surprising team when you consider how many people they lost. And the Red Sox will be in the World Series against Philadelphia, and they will take them in four games in spite of that pitching staff.
Let us hope.
Philadelphia has no hitting. The Red Sox have an incredible team. It's shocking. And the Yanks made a terrible mistake. I remember shouting about it. We got rid of this wonderful relief pitcher, Alfredo Aceves, the Mexican. Francona insisted upon picking him up, was dead right, and he's now your fourth starter, and it's wonderful. The Yanks are terrible. Cashman should be shot at dawn. Girardi can be forgiven, but you might as well shoot him too. And half the team should be discarded. They should just bring up everybody from Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, and Trenton, because this gang are not going to get in. But where were we? Yes.
We were talking about the anxiety of influence.
Derek Jeter, we'll go back to that. But think about American prejudice. Derek Jeter, like Barack Obama, has a white mother and an African-American father. Never in his entire career, if somebody said now, the black Yankee captain and shortstop Derek Jeter, everybody would say, what? What are you talking about? These things don't work in baseball anymore. Baseball is indeed now emancipated. Who knows who's who anymore? Whereas in politics, though Barack Obama is not necessarily any more black, whatever that means, it's obviously just a bugaboo in the mind of the fascists. Never mind. Let us go back to anxiety. But I know nothing about politics, except that even though I'm somewhat disappointed in Barack Obama, he hasn't exactly turned out to be Abraham Lincoln. He's a very good Chicago pal. But he's all we've got, and I will contribute money again and vote for him, perhaps holding my nose a little.
I was thinking
he's made very bad mistakes, but go on.
Here's what I want to know, Harold. How different is the anxiety of influence that you write about among the poets?
How different from what?
From the anxiety of Karl Yastrzemski, say, playing in Ted Williams' left field.
No difference. Absolutely no difference. You can say if you want to, as I've demonstrated again and again, though nobody seems to pay any attention to this, that what I'm talking about is not necessarily. I mean, sometimes the belated poet, as I call her or him, has an actual existential anxiety in regard to a precursor figure or figures, sometimes a composite, an imaginary one. But that doesn't matter. It's a metaphoric or tropological relationship. The tropological range, the metaphoric range, the kind of metaphors that are used and the way they work are formed and malformed by what I call the anxiety of influence.
Let me just say, I love about the book that it's so playful, Harold, including your...
Mischievous, a British reviewer, the one nice British reviewer said, yes.
I like your riff on your own name.
Oh, yes. But it's you know, thank heavens.
May I read a sentence of this?
Yes, go on, and then I have something to say about it.
You write, I am moved here by my own splendid name of Bloom, particularly since my personal favorite among Whitman's poems is, of course, When Lilacs Last in the Dooryard Bloomed. charmed as I also am by Stevensian
trapped in the dooryard by his own capacious bloom.
Amen. It seems to me the most literary of names, though a price is paid.
I must tell you a story about this. My late, alas, father died a long time ago. I'm about to turn 81. Papa died of brain cancer when he was just 73. Lovely man. He and his three brothers were all born and raised in a terrible city for Jews then, and for most other people, Odessa. Mm. You know, Crimea, Russia, now part of the Ukraine, actually, legally. They had quarreled with their father, my paternal grandfather, whom, like my maternal grandfather, I never met, plus my uncles and aunts and cousins by the dozens, all of whom were murdered by the Nazis. But never mind. At Ellis Island, they split in half, the four brothers, coming to America. The family name was Brookstein.
Ah.
Two of the brothers changed it to Brooks. My father and another brother, my father was the oldest, went back to their mother's maiden name of Bloom. I've been perpetually grateful. When you think of the long, terrible wars I had to fight with the long ago vanquished fascist Yale English Department, I use the word fascist advisedly, of the Yale English Department that I arrived at as a graduate student here in the autumn of 51 and finally abandoned in 1976, when I went to the Yale provost and acting president, Hannah Gray, and said, Hannah, I've just finished 3 years as the Devane professor lecturing to the whole university. I'm not going back to the Yale English department. And I became Bloom Professor of Bloom, as I've been ever since. But one of the people I always had to fight tooth and nail was Cleanth Brooks, and how horrible if I, the most Yiddish of critics, had been named Harold Brooks and not Harold Bloom. But I would not have liked that, Chris, darling.
Serious question. Why compare Cleanth Brooks? I very vaguely remember him saying, is this a good poem or is it a bad poem? But why compare him to the Nazis?
That's mean of me. So I will partly retract. But I would like to say something, Chris, darling, before that. We're both speaking on so many valences once.
Yeah, so many threads. Would you just go back to your father?
Oh, I know. Behind all of this was the great Anglo-fascist himself. Look, let us tell the truth about Thomas Stearns Eliot, eventually OM, Order of Merit, by the King of England. Thomas Stearns Eliot, though I hate to admit it, was a very great American poet. But he was, as you know, a sustained, deliberate, and really vicious anti-Semite. The best thing you could say about it, he had a polite hatred of the Jewish people. Now, you would hardly expect me to worship at the shrine of Thomas Stearns Eliot, who politely hated me. We met once briefly, and we certainly didn't care for each other. But I was still very young at the time. Though actually, astonishingly, my second book, The Visionary Company of Reading English Romantic Poetry, which was published by Doubleday Anchor originally here in the United States, was picked up by Eliot and published by Faber and Faber.
Hmm.
I've never understood that. But never mind. That's so far back. That was 1961. My God, that's 50 years ago.
Hmm.
That's shocking. 50 years ago.
Harold, explain to
me. I've been publishing books now since 1957. That's 54 years now.
Hmm.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. Old as those that lived and loved 1,000 years ago. Never mind, go on.
Question. Go back to your papa in the ballpark, yes, in the Bronx.
No, that was my Uncle Sam. No, he took me to Yankee Stadium. Also, he influenced my life because I remember one day, that's when I was six, but one day when I was about 10 or 11 and was spending all my time reading Hart Crane and Shakespeare and John Milton and Walt Whitman, you know the poets who mattered. I think I'd even begun on Edmund Spenser at that point, though I hadn't reached Chaucer. And he said to me, Herula, which is what they called me, what are you going to do with all this when you grow up? I think it was about 11 at the time. 11. 1941. 70 years ago. I remember this conversation vividly. He said, what are you going to do with this? I said, well, I don't know. I just want to read poems and talk about them, and I hope write about them. I hadn't written about them as yet. He said, well, he said, there are two places, I'd never heard of them before, Harvard and Yale. I said, yes, what are they? He said, they're universities where I think there are professors of poetry. So I put that away in my mind, and I thought of Uncle Sam, who was then long dead, during the academic year 1987-88, when I was simultaneously Charles Eliot Norton Professor of Poetry at Harvard University and Sterling Professor of the Humanities at Yale University. Oof. His prophecy had been fulfilled.
Harold, I was going to ask you, what would your father make of you? What you have mastered, what you have learned, what you have
Papa
written?
Had no, neither Papa nor Mama or even my sisters. But in any case, he said to me one day when I was going off to Cornell in Yiddish, he said, what are you doing? What do you intend to be? A Malamed? You know, Yiddish for a school teacher. I said, well, you know, again in Yiddish, you know, yeah, Papa, but on a somewhat higher level, I hope. He said, no, he said, anything better than that. If you don't want to be a doctor and a lawyer, as you should be, you're wasting all this education. Better you should be a pharmacist than a Muhammad. So I don't think he would have been much moved or much interested or much impressed.
Would he understand how you did it? You mastered that material?
My dear fellow, I don't understand how I did it. The ultimate truth about me, which I think I would say only to Chris Lydon, because notoriously I love the man, and I believe you somewhat reciprocate my fierce affections.
I do.
I have no idea how it all happened. I went to a terrible high school, at least for me, a dreadful place called the Bronx High School of Science, simply because if I'd gone to the neighborhood high school, DeWitt Clinton, I would have been beaten up by various thugs, and I didn't want that. Hmm. I'd already lost too many fistfights and so on. So I went to the Bronx Science. And hated it. I hated the students. I hated the teachers. I hated the atmosphere. And I finished at the bottom of my class.
Really?
Except for a young physicist who I hope is still alive and well, Michael Cohn. But I finished second to him in my Cornell class.
Harold, here's a big picture question, but it's the one I want, that I always think of when I read a book like The Anatomy of Influence. What does it mean to you at age 80, to have come to English literature, all of it, and American literature, through a Jewish lens, having spoken Yiddish first.
The first poets I loved and tried to understand and certainly read deeply were the great modern American Yiddish poets, particularly Moshe Leib Halpern, marvelous poet, but also Mani Leib, Yaakov Glotstein, a few others like that. What shall I say? It's all a question of perspective. That extraordinary, talented, if somewhat strange, Jewish American story writer and novelist Cynthia Ozick.
Yes.
Devoted an entire essay in a book called Art and Ardor to accusing Harold Bloom of being, this is verbatim, an anti-Jewish critic.
Really?
Well, from her crazy perspective, from the perspective of what she would regard as normative Judaism. She accused me of lacking what she called Jewish information, whatever the hell that is supposed to be. Normative Judaism is a series of masks that people put on through the ages, one after another. There's no such thing as normative Judaism, just as there isn't really normative Christianity.
But if there were such a thing as normative Judaism, how would you have avoided it? How would you have escaped it?
Oh, they raised me in what they thought it was. But even when I had my bar mitzvah at 13, I got into terrible quarrels with the rabbis because I just, I said, I don't like Yahweh. I still don't.
Right.
I don't like him. I don't trust him. I wish he would go away, even though, alas, he won't. But still, he's too powerful a metaphor for the world to get rid of. But he's a terrible, destructive idea. I have a book, my next book, called marvelously The Shadow of a Great Rock. And it's a shorter book than this. The subtitle is A Literary Appreciation of the King James Bible. I love the title because in the King James Bible, which is so beautiful anyway, so frequently, but Isaiah 32, verse 2, it's one of the 9 or 10 most beautiful things. And a man shall be as a shelter from the wind, as the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. The Hebrew says in a dry land, but even though it's a mistranslation, the beautiful cadence of weary land is wonderful. And quite frequently they mistranslate because they love those cadences, which I love too.
May I ask you a question?
Yes.
The reason I love you so much, Harold, and I come back to your books always, is simply, it's that line that you use about poetry as ecstatic cognitive music.
Yes.
It's so mysterious. Yes. It's so profoundly unknowable.
Of course, isn't that true of the best bop? Isn't that true of the best jazz?
Or the best Brahms, or the best Bach.
Yes, the best Bach, the best Beethoven, the best Johannes Brahms, the best Mozart and Haydn, certainly. The best Stravinsky, though he was a nasty man, a very great composer. And certainly the best Louis.
Amen.
The best Charlie Mingus, the best Duke Ellington, the best Thelonious and Budd, the best Art Tatum. And, you know, there's so many of these great figures. It is... it's ecstatic cognitive music. I suppose the difference between bop and Louis, or not necessarily between bop and Duke, is that it is cognitive music in bop. You can hear in Parker.
Absolutely.
In a great piece like Parker's Mood, which I can never get out of my inner ear. And sometimes in the middle of the night, it just plays itself through for me. Remember that great moment in Parker's Mood?
I do.
It's extraordinary. It is cognitive music.
Well, so is Sonny Rollins in 1949 with Roy Haynes and Bud Powell.
Yes, yes. Marvelous. Most marvelous. And he's still with us.
I think of Sonny Rollins as the Walt Whitman of our time. Assimilator, traveler, storyteller, American... improviser.
He has a Whitmanian grandeur to him, just as Bud Powell had a kind of tragic sublimity of Hart Crane's kind.
Yeah, yeah.
Louis is a much happier phenomenon. Louis is almost the Shakespeare of jazz.
Ecstatic cognitive music is a phrase that is so full of emotion, so full of energy and love, but almost excludes theory of any kind.
I don't like theory. People used to mix me up with theorists because my gang here at Yale, the late Paul Dumont, he and I loved each other personally, but we couldn't agree on anything. Jacques Derrida, we were friends for a while, but they're both dead now, of course. But we broke after the revelations about, Paul's dark episode.
The fascist stuff.
Belgian fascism, yeah. And I never did talk to Jacques again because he insulted me, but never mind. And of course, Hillis Miller, who's alive and well up in Maine, I think. And my friend, as I always call him, the maximum Ayatollah Hartmani, Jeffrey Hartman. But they, as I explained, for anybody who was willing to listen, I got the book together. I assembled the so-called Yale critics. I picked the title, I got the publisher, called it Deconstruction and Criticism, and plainly meant, as anybody who would see who looked at my essay in it, that they were deconstruction and I was literary criticism. I loathe theory. I've never had any use for theory. I'm a practical, a pragmatic literary critic of admittedly a somewhat eccentric kind. So who knows what eccentric is? One goes back to Emerson. Emerson turned out to be centric rather than eccentric. I don't know where I will be after my death. I may just be totally forgotten. But if I'm not forgotten, I may look more at the center than I've looked up to now. It's very hilarious what's going on. Somebody sent me a book the other day with 11 or 12 Brits in it. I forget the title. It's published by the Manchester University Press in the UK. All 12 essays deal with me. At the beginning in the introduction, they powerfully insult me, the two editors. They say he's pedantic, he's silly, he's conservative. I mean, all sorts of insults. And I stared at this and I sort of glanced at the essays. I couldn't bear to read them. And I threw the book into the permanent and circular file in the backyard. But I had to ask myself, if you really felt that way, kids, why did a dozen of you get together and spend all that time and publish a book denouncing somebody who's pedantic, silly, conservative? There were a few other terms of opprobrium in there. What are they talking about? I read just enough of a couple of essays to see that poor creatures, I had raped their minds and they didn't know it, or perhaps they were on anxiety of influence indeed. They were shouting at me in my own vocabulary, using my own techniques. It happens.
In the new book, Harold, you say flat out, theory will be alien to American literature and its most useful criticism.
Yes, of course.
Is it over?
It's dead. It's totally dead. You know, there are still the relics of Paul DeMond at Cornell and to some extent here in the foreign language departments, but basically it's over.
This is probably too simple, Harold, but my pleasure in you is that you come at literature fundamentally as an enthusiast, which sounds too bubble-headed, but as an affirmer, as a reader, and as somebody who enjoys it so much.
I call the first section of this book Literary Love. I think that in order for later poets to be profoundly influenced by earlier poets, they have to begin by falling in love with the poems. But of course, love of all kinds, as you and I and this young man know, if you're fiercely enough in love, it carries its ambivalences. And those ambivalences constitute part, at least, of the phenomenon I call the anxiety of influence. But I am passionately, when I call the subtitle of this literature as a way of life, I mean that. I think that there are people who love religion. I don't, though I'm very interested in it. There are people who love history. I hate history. I agree with James Joyce. It's a nightmare from which we should try to awake, but we can't. There are people who love science or philosophy. I don't. I think we are in a society now for more than a century, and it will go on this way, I fear, in the Western world. And perhaps by now there's no distinction between the Western and Eastern world. We're in a society where all our cognitive modes have failed us. And my late friend, Richard Rorty, with whom I exchanged fierce influences and we always loved each other, Dick once said to me, you know, Harold, and I think he put in one of his books somewhere because we had a long discussion about it. He said, you once said that when the cognitive modes, philosophy, science, religion, history, fail a society, then willy-nilly, whether it wants to or not, it becomes a literary culture. I said, yes, Dick, and I'm not so sure, my dear, that this is good for literature or good for society, but I think this is what has happened. Even now, in the digital age, though we call it by different names and we adulterate the phenomenon, we live in a literary culture.
Meaning what, Harold?
I won't talk about my own students because they are elitist. They are aesthetic. They have real, rare cognitive power. But young people in general, and to some extent all of us, we live without belief. Where are we to turn to be moved? I don't know that there are, at this moment, major contemporary writers in any of the Western languages who speak to the young in particular. I'm not sure of that. In my generation, and that's well before your generation, Wallace Stevens spoke to us, Hart Crane spoke to us, Faulkner. spoke to us. Yeats, D.H. Lawrence spoke to us. I'm not sure that there are any writers around now, but it's a question of what is going to form your minds when, intellectually speaking, you know, religion, philosophy, science, history, these are now stuffed birds upon the shelf. They're not live birds that you can hold in your hand. If you're going to be warmed into life, if your mind is to catch fire, it can only be through great imaginative literature. And of course, at that point, you go into the figure of figures. I mean, all the world's literature in the end is epitomized by William Shakespeare. If you really learn to read for yourself, not influenced by A.C. Bradley, not influenced by Harold Bloom, not influenced by this one or that one, but really read for yourself deeply, King Lear, Macbeth, the Falstaff plays, Henry IV, Part 1 and Part 2, Antony and Cleopatra, Othello, the great comedies, Twelfth Night, As You Like It. When you really have a deep relationship to those works, then you change. You start indeed like Shakespearean characters, overhearing yourself. And of course, what in some sense you're overhearing is Shakespeare's languages, Shakespeare's thoughts. I think I quote somewhere in this book a man who meant a great deal to me, Owen Barfield. He once said to me at lunch, I was so struck by it, I've repeated it 20 times since in everything I've written about Shakespeare, I repeat it there. He liked my repeating it, he told me in a letter, so he finally put it in one of his books. He said, I'm not sure I have the exact wording, but it's pretty close, almost verbatim. He said, it can positively chagrin us when we come to realize that what we want to think are our own emotions originally was Shakespeare's thoughts. That's a beautiful sentence and a very profound and truthful observation. What the three fellows sitting here together, what Gene Bloom, who'll be back shortly, what we think of as our own emotions, the way we love, the way we laugh, the way we sorrow, the way we grieve, the way we suffer anxieties. How did we learn these things? We learned them either by directly reading Shakespeare or having it refracted by those who come after Shakespeare but who wouldn't have written as they did without Shakespeare. So it is a perilous and strange kind of thing. Our souls, our minds, our spirits, our hearts. It's what I meant, that much abused title of a huge book of some 800 pages that I wrote some years ago in the 1990s, I think it was, on Shakespeare, called The Invention of the Human. Everybody, even if they more or less tolerated the book, smashed at the title and said, what nonsense to say he invented us. Obviously, had they read the great Samuel Johnson, they would have known that the great man said, the essence of poetry is invention. That is to say, discovery, originality. And if you say that Shakespeare invented the human, what you mean, quite modestly but accurately, is there's a great deal about both ourselves and about one another and about all of life that was always there, but we would not have seen it, particularly in the way we do see it now. Seen it in the different ways, because it varies from one of us to another, except for Shakespeare. In that sense, I quote the great Ralph Waldo Emerson, my other hero of this mode, besides the great sage of Concord, far greater than the so-called sage of New Haven. Shakespeare wrote the text of modern life. There it is. Yeah. Shakespeare wrote the text of modern life.
That was Emerson who said, Shakespeare wrote the text of modern life.
Wrote the text of modern life.
I've heard. I want to go back to one. You distinguished between normative Judaism and Jewishness as an emotional and historical condition.
Well, also as an intellectual matter also. I mean, my sense of history and of the role of memory in human life is essentially, I don't know if it's Judaic, but it's certainly Jewish. My sense of morality, even though I can't live up to it, it all goes back to the great Hillel, who said there are three things that matter. He said to his disciples, be deliberate in judgment, raise up many disciples of your own, which I interpret not as disciples since I don't want any student to resemble me in any way, but teach as many good students as possible. And then he puts it magnificently, put a hedge around the Torah, but a hedge is an opal enclosure, and I've substituted the Western canon for the Torah. And the greater figure even, well, not a greater figure, but the one who pierces my heart from the time I was a boy, the great Rabbi Akiba, who's really the founder of what we now call normative Judaism, if you want to call it that, had a friend and rival, the great Tarfon, who had been a priest of the temple. In English, probably Tarfon or perhaps Tarphon. And I've really lived my life and kept working by his great apothem or aphorism. It is not required of you that you complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it. Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinarily balanced statement. Mm-hmm. If the impossibility of completing the work in any sense of you or I or this gentleman here or my wife completing the work, it can't be completed. Therefore, it's not required. But then you have the corollary, neither are you free to desist from it. So that's why I go on teaching, one of the reasons, at 81, and we'll go on teaching to the end. That's why I go on writing. That's why I go on reading.
Praise God for your energy, Harold.
What energy? I have no energy.
Yes, you
I'm
do.
Exhausted.
In this book, you speak of so many writers that you have known, and it's an interesting, it goes from Philip Roth and Tony Kushner and John Hollander and Anthony Burgess and W.H. Auden.
As I've gotten older, I feel this about Philip. Unless I really personally like a writer enormously, like John Ashbery, or if I saw more of him, Tony Kushner, who's so sweet-natured, as John Ashbery is the sweetest kind of a human being. Roth, at his best, was a great writer, not anymore, but in two great books, in particular, Sabbath Theater and American Pastoral. But I increasingly realize I don't want to know writers that closely anymore, unless they are by now old friends or younger writers who become good friends, like the wonderful Boston poet Henri Cole,
yes,
who I think is the poet of his generation, as he will increasingly demonstrate. Better to know their work than to know them. Mm. I'm getting too old. I don't want to use up, you speak of energy, I haven't got much energy left at all.
Mm.
I don't want to waste it on sort of knowing temperamental people.
Hmm.
I want to know my students. You know, I've got it down now, two groups of 12 each semester, if possible, carrying them through the year. I've really gotten to know them this last year. I've helped them find the right jobs for them in New York City when they wanted it, at places like The New Yorker and Vanity Fair and the whole Random House empire and so on. But they've influenced me. You know, they've taught me a great deal, including something about my personal limitations. So these have become my grandchildren. In fact, since most of them are 20 or 21, and I'm going to be 81, almost great-grandchildren. Some of them indeed are the children of former students. So it's a familial kind of a thing.
Mm. Harold Bloom, you give us so much. I cannot thank you enough.
Kindlelock, you will come back.
Harold, I want to come back in the fall and take your course on Melville and Moby Dick, please.
All right, I'd be delighted to see you.
Back Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.